In today's episode of This Week in Law, we have Brandon Butler, David Frankel, Sarah Pearson, and me, and we find a way for the DMCA to creep into things that you just wouldn't expect. The Ashley Madison adultery site, for example. Drones and needing to provide safety against hacked devices for another. We're going to talk about Apple Music 2, the important film on decision, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 312, recorded July 24th, 2015. Neither holy, Roman, nor empire. This episode is brought to you by Varidesk. Convert your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk. Varidesk is height adjustable and lets you easily switch between sitting and standing. To learn more, visit varidesk.com. That's Vari desk.com. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm so excited that you're joining us this week. We've got some really interesting stories to try and unpack, help you understand what's going on at the intersection of technology and law. And we've got a really brilliant and excellent panel with us today to help accomplish that important task. Both of these folks have been on the show recently. So if you've been missing them, welcome them back. We've got Brandon Butler. He teaches at the American University Washington College of Law, where he also runs the Gleshko Samuelson Intellectual Property Law Clinic. Hello, Brandon.
Hey, Denise. Good to be here.
Great to have you back. Also joining us today is drone lawyer David Frankel. He practices in South Dakota. And there has been a lot of interesting drone law stuff going on, not just this week, but in general. Hi, David.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Great to have you back. Also back with us is my co-host, Sarah Pearson, who is senior counsel at Creative Commons. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Denise. I'm looking forward to today's show.
I am too. Let's get right to it. Lots of really interesting stuff to discuss. Let's start out in the arena of copyright. You know, until this week, I never really associated adultery with copyright law, but now we can, thanks to the website Ashley Madison, which was hacked, and its user data of over 37 million users was leaked by an organization who did not like that what the Ashley Madison site is all about is helping people enter into adulterous relationships. Ashley Madison fought back however it could. Parker Higgins called them in cornered animal mode, which I think is very apt. And one of the ways that it fought back and tried to keep its user data from being spread very widely was using the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, going to sites who were republishing this leaked data and saying, that is our copyrighted data that you have on your site, and you have to take it down per the notice and takedown provisions of the DMCA. Novel approach to repurpose the DMCA that way, but not exactly what the law was intended for, and probably, if challenged, would not hold up because people's personal information held by a website is not a creative work that the copyright law was designed to protect. Brandon, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, oh, I mean, you hit the biggest issue right up front, Denise. I mean, this is sort of like the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, right? to have a takedown under the DMCA, you have to allege that this material is copyrighted, that it belongs to you, and that its use is infringing. And I don't think Ashley Madison wins any of those, right? A list of names and passwords is not creative, as you said. It's a database. If they were in Europe, you know, they might have a database right that they could get into protecting in over there. But here, the rights and data are thin if they exist at all. And so most copyright scholars, I think, would say a simple list of names and passwords is not something that's going to be protected. The second question is, does it belong to them? You know, I think Parker raised this, you know, and several other folks have said, you know, gosh, do they own their users' names? And again, if there's a copyright in this at all, which I doubt there is. But then the third one is also interesting, and it's really important in this context of takedowns sent out to journalists and websites. You know, is the posting of this information infringing copyright? I mean, this is pretty yucky stuff. You know, I find myself almost feeling like a First Amendment lawyer defending the Nazis marching in Skokie. But, you know, there might be a real newsworthiness argument. Maybe it's at least possible. And so there might be a fair use type of argument. So even if they owned it, it didn't belong to their users, and it was copyrighted, there's at least a possibility that it's not infringing. And so every time someone uses the DMCA in this way to try and silence a journalist or to take something down off the web, you know, you have to ask those three questions. Is this mine? Is it copyrighted? And is this an infringement? And too rarely nowadays, no one asks any of those questions. They just say, I want it down, and they send a letter.
Right. That's an excellent point. The last point that you just raised, all your points were excellent, but the one that you just raised, I hadn't thought through this story enough to really get there. And that is how similar this is to a WikiLeaks kind of situation where there is quite possibly a newsworthy aspect to the data that was leaked going back to General Petraeus several years ago, that kind of thing. And so, yes, if there is the chilling effect of the DMCA being used to make the data unavailable, then we're not only having copyright law misused, but it's being misused in a way that quells speech, which, like I said, I hadn't quite gotten there in thinking through this story. So thank you for that. What do you think about this, David?
Well, I think that Brandon's right on with his comments, particular statute, and it seems like it's being abused. But when you look at the fundamentals, there was a theft from someone of something. The proceeds of that theft being disseminated and other people benefiting from the proceeds of that theft strikes me as inequitable. So there must be some other legal argument, possibly based on conversion or the imposition of a constructive trust, things that go back to black letter law that don't specifically key off of that that one particular copyright statute. That would be my feeling. It is a gray area. But where you have people benefiting from an intentionally wrongful act, then I think you have grounds to stop that those people accepting those benefits.
Right. There are certainly anti-hacking statutes that would thwart the hacktivist here, which calls itself the impact team, and hopefully root them out and punish them for the initial hack. Now that's not such an easy thing to do. And I'm wondering, I haven't seen any coverage of where things are on that front. So if folks have, please enlighten us and let us know if Ashley Madison is going to the police, pressing charges, the various recourses they can have for having been hacked. Sarah, have you seen anything on that?
I haven't. And I'm guessing that they're just using the DMCA because it's the quickest, it's a quick and easy way to deal with it. I think in a lot of these situations, the DMCA gets used a fair amount for privacy harms like this. And in a lot of cases, it's hard not to sympathize with the person that's using the DMCA. This isn't one of those because the Ashley Madison site is not a very sympathetic case there. But I think that happens a lot. But it's still, I think, a negative thing to be using this copyright tool for something that it's completely not supposed to be used for. And as Brandon pointed out, for a lot of reasons, it's not even probably a valid DMCA notice and takedown to begin with. So,
right. Quoting Parker Higgins again, if I can pull up his tweet, he had a very succinct response. If my keyboard were responding quite as succinctly. There we go. The DMCA isn't even good at being copyright law. Trust me, it's really lousy at being privacy law, says Parker. excellent point, but David makes a good one too, Brandon, that there needs to be some kind of recourse. We can't just let people like the impact team decide that they're going to make a point and break the law. There has to be some kind of ability now for Ashley Madison to take steps. So how do you feel about, you know, if they were not misusing the DMCA in the way that you described, how do you feel about their other recourse?
Well, you know, one issue may be that, copyright owners have been very good at getting, or they were in the 90s for sure, they got the DMCA passed, and the DMCA is a very effective statute. And so, you know, we might ask, whether this suggests that, you know, and I don't know, I feel dirty saying this, but maybe there should be some similar step. Maybe that there should be another type of statute like the DMCA that would allow for privacy-based, you know, fast privacy-based takedown claims, so that, you know, the rationale behind the DMCA was, you know, look, in the modern digital era, once something leaks onto the internet, we, the rights holders, need to be able to take it down fast, and a copyright lawsuit takes a long time, so we need a mechanism that lets us get a remedy that's much more on demand than a lawsuit is. And so maybe there's a similar, in the era of revenge porn and doxing and so on, maybe there's something to be said for a kind of privacy DMCA that is, maybe Parker has it kind of backwards. The DMCA is actually pretty good at being copyright law, but it's not good at being privacy law, and so privacy needs a DMCA of its own. I don't know. Again, I don't love the DMCA for a lot of other reasons, so it makes me feel dirty to say that, but that might be the answer. You know, there's an interesting link here, too, to Gawker, just in the sense that there was this recent story that Gawker did about a high-profile media executive who had texted a prostitute. And Gawker made a story out of that, you know, look, you know, and they named his name, they outed him, he was gay, but he was married with children. And Gawker walked back that story and said, you know, this isn't newsworthy, this isn't, the editor did, and then other folks resigned from Gawker over this. So the question of whether this kind of information is even news and whether it should be protected, I think, is probably the most fraught aspect of this whole thing. You know, should a law allow someone to take this off the web is the hardest question to me.
You know, it's funny, VA Slim and IRC and I were thinking along the same lines as you were talking there, Brandon, and that is, I was thinking that you were kind of describing the right to be forgotten regime in the EU. Is that what you had in mind, or something a little different you think is needed in the U.S.?
Well, I guess it would be a little bit different. I'm not super familiar with how the right to be forgotten works. But I was not thinking of saying, you know, well, this is something that was true, but that I would like to, that is no longer useful or whatever. It's a very weird standard that the right to be forgotten has. I was thinking more along the lines of an invasion of privacy. You know, this is information that was never public and should never have been public. And, you know, maybe based, again, just as a copyright owner has to say, I have a copyright, and if I go to court and sue this person, I could win. Maybe someone should have to make a similar claim grounded in privacy. I have a privacy right, and if I have to go and sue this person, I would win. And of course, the person posting it could then do a counter notice, just as a YouTube user can do a counter notice and say, no, this is fair use, it's newsworthy, or it's not a privacy violation. So, I don't know. I shouldn't be thinking out loud like this. I hope no legislator is listening.
I hope they are, because they're important issues, and we're going to have Colette Vogel back on the show in the fall, and I'd love to loop her into this conversation. We'll have to do it in sort of delayed form when she's back on the show, but she has an initiative called Without My Consent that is all about taking down information that is leaked about you without your consent. So it does sort of go into this Ashley Madison situation. You know, no matter how you feel about the site, which, you know, it's a bad poster child for this scenario. You know, I think most people sort of look at the site and with a degree of disapprobation that's close to the hackers in this case. But that doesn't mean that what the hacker did here was correct.
Denise?
Yes.
Well, I wanted to add, did I misread it, or was this also some element of fraud on behalf of the website where they had advertised an extra charge for a deleted account, and that part of what the hackers were doing here was exposing the fact that they collected some $1.2 million of fees for supposedly deleting accounts, which were not in fact deleted, and bringing that to the light of day. So again, I'm not defending the hack, but what I am doing is suggesting that by no means does this website have clean hands going into this. And there are a number of injured parties, all of whom seem to be the spouses of the users of the website, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know, you know, there are certainly those allegations in the coverage that there were representations about paying extra fees for having anonymity and avoiding just this sort of problem. So apparently Ashley Madison is kind of a smarmy outfit in any number of ways, and probably pretty much dangled themselves out there as a target, if what the impact team has to say about that is true. So I guess it's a lesson to websites. If you're going to operate in gray moral areas, you know, you're definitely painting a big target on yourself. So again, you know, it's a tough issue because we have laws in, there's nothing about what, oh, here's an interesting point. I was going to say there's nothing about what Ashley Madison was doing that is illegal, but that's not as clear cut as you might think it is, because there are states in the United States where adultery is illegal. So in those states, at least Ashley Madison is helping people commit misdemeanors, and or I believe in Massachusetts, I read that it might even be a felony. So
Denise, I can tell you in South Dakota, it's one of the few states where someone can sue for damages a man or woman that steals their spouse.
Wow. So, does that happen very often?
It happened. There was a lawsuit about 2 years ago, and it happens very rarely, but nonetheless, it is a recognizable legal claim to sue for damages based on adultery.
Right. So leaving those isolated cases aside, and there are countries too, obviously. So this is an internationally operating website, one assumes. There are countries where adultery is illegal as well. So let's just assume for a moment that weren't the case, and that none of the users of the site were engaging in any crimes anywhere. Then this is a little bit more problematic to think that they can be hacked and again have recourse may not be completely where it should be for this kind of incident. Brandon, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, the law and economics perspective comes into play here. Sort of, who's the least cost avoider here? And in a way, it might have been Ashley Madison, right? I mean, everything I've read about this says that, you know, there were easy things that they could have and should have done to protect their users, and that they didn't do. And so, while of course Impact Team is doing something bad, really Ashley Madison ought to be held accountable. And all of their like, well, don't you worry, users, we're going to use the DMCA to protect you. I'm with Parker. They're in cornered animal mode, and they know that they really screwed up here and that, that a lot of people are going to be very mad at them, and they're trying to divert blame.
All right. Let's move on to the state of Georgia's being very mad at somebody. That is Carl Malamud, who we talk about quite a bit on the show. Carl runs publicresource.org, and publicresource.org stands for the proposition that laws are not copyrightable. The actual text of laws enacted by lawmaking bodies in the United States, the state and federal governments, courts, statutes, etc., are not subject to copyright. Should seem a pretty basic notion. If they were subject to copyright, then citing laws in briefs and on the web and republishing portions of them for discussion would be very, very difficult. It gets complicated when people do a little value added to the law, and that's what the state of Georgia does. It publishes its own laws instead of outsourcing it to a private party publisher. And it annotates its own laws, which means it will describe the substance of the law, the ramifications of the law. It will provide some context and, as I said, value add to the laws when they are published. And by doing so, Georgia claims that now its laws are copyrightable. So it has that puts it directly head-to-head with publicresource.org over republication of the law. And Georgia has now sued publicresource.org and is trying to recover damages and enjoin any sort of republication of Georgia's laws. Brandon, you put this in our rundown. What can you add for us?
Well, I think this is so fascinating because we're sort of tap dancing along a line that usually takes, you know, one or two classes in my copyright class to help students understand. Because, you know, we know that works of the federal government are in the public domain, right? If it's written by a federal employee in the scope of their employment, it's in the public domain. And that includes not just laws, but you know, the Government Accountability Office reports, Congressional Research Service reports, all kinds of stuff, all kinds of really good stuff, by the way. There's really fun, interesting archival stuff that all is that belongs to us the minute it was created. That's fine. Works of most state governments, however, are not necessarily in the public domain. It's up to the state to decide whether it's going to assert its copyrights, and many of them do, in works of their employees. So if someone who works for the state of Arizona writes a pamphlet, you know, come visit Arizona with photographs and essays and so on, that can be registered for copyright and it belongs to the state of Arizona. But the laws of the states are not supposed to be copyrightable because they're laws. And this is not something that is in the Federal Copyright Act, I don't think. I think it goes back to a Supreme Court decision. And so, you know, state laws are not copyrightable, but other works of the state are copyrightable. And so Carl has been for a long time now, Carl Malamud, the publicresource.org guy, sort of seeing how far he can push the line of what is a state law as distinct from what is a work of the state that is copyrightable. And so that's what's happening here. And Carl is arguing, and I think, you know, on the face of it fairly compellingly, that Georgia has created this official annotated version of the Georgia State Code. And the fact that it's official, you know, the official code of Georgia annotated means any lawyer, you know, respectable lawyer who wants to understand what the law of Georgia is needs not only the bare statutory text, but the official annotations of that text. And so Carl was saying, look, all of this goes into the law bucket. And Georgia is saying, no, this is just like a tourism pamphlet. We're just, you know, helping you out. It's not a law yet. It's just something we wrote. And, it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. He's been pushing this for a while. Other states have sent him nasty grams, Mississippi and one other state, Idaho, have said, you know, stop doing what you're doing. And Carl has written back, and I think Chris Sprigman, who's a professor at NYU, is representing Carl, at least, or was until he got sued. He may lawyer up a little more heavily now. But Chris Sprigman would send these very funny letters back saying, you know, look, you don't own this stuff and we're going to keep on doing it, so sue us. So I think Carl Malamud was courting this lawsuit because he wants to prove this point. And I look forward to seeing if he can pull it off. My heart is with him.
Yes, ours too. And listener trivia for our listeners. Chris has been on the show before and has also come up recently on the show because he also represented the gentleman who 3D printed the left shark. So he has an interesting batch of clients that he involves himself with and writes great letters. Those should be copyrightable for sure. Sarah, any thoughts about copywriting the law?
And I should say Chris is also on the Creative Commons board, which is kind of cool. No, I mean, I think that this is one of those situations where copyright law just seems crazy to think that this is even potentially copyrightable and that the state would try to stop someone from distributing this. Is just, I don't think it just completely seems counterintuitive, I would think, to the general public. There are lots of copyright questions that are interesting and you can go out, you could imagine either side, but this one to me just doesn't pass that smell test at all. The incentive argument, it sounds like the state of Georgia is making the argument that they need copyright in order to incentivize themselves to actually annotate copies of the law. And that seems like a real stretch to me too. So I'm anxious to see what comes of it. But I'm certainly rooting for Carl on this one.
Right. What about you, David? Do you think, how about the annotation aspect? Does that give us a sufficient copyrighted creative work, or should they be able to perhaps carve those out?
Well, of course, the annotations themselves would be copyrightable. It doesn't turn the public domain work part of it into a copyright protected part, but it's well known that anyone can take a public domain work, add their own creative content to that, and the part that they add, it would be a derivative work, would it not? And that would be protected by copyright. I don't see any reason why the annotations would be different. When I was a young lawyer and we had such things as books, we would go into the library and we would find the annotations were a very valuable component of doing our legal research. Someone had to put those annotations together. It took time and money to do that. And I'm not sure that the point is well taken. No disrespect, Sarah, but I'm not sure the point is well taken that someone would go through the time and energy and money spent to create those annotations or to create helpful annotations if there were no protection in it. So, bottom line, I don't think it converts the public domain part to something that's copyrightable, but the part that it is the annotations that were created, originally and by the employees of the state should be protected.
The problem I see with that is the official annotation aspect that Brandon brought up earlier, and that is that when the annotations are written by the state, in my mind, they take on extra force and you know, sometimes they're cited and relied on almost precedentially in a way that the West annotations, that's a third party legal publisher. I realize we're kind of out in the legal weeds here, but in the way that third party annotations are not. Brandon, do you agree?
I think that's exactly right. And look, I can say this because I'm from Georgia. We don't like taxes down there. They don't like taxes down there. I've moved to Maryland and we love taxes here. And when we get something from the state, we just pay for it. But in Georgia, they like to get things from the state and not have to pay for it. And so the idea that Georgia would use copyright and, you know, selling the law as a way to avoid having to raise taxes is not a surprise to me. I can see the sort of incentive story, and I can frankly see Georgia legislators saying, well, if y'all aren't going to pay for this, then we're not going to write it. But I think it gets right back to what Denise said. You know, even if there's an incentive story here, and even if there's creativity, and I've certainly, David's right that you can absolutely, annotations can be creative, often are, generally are, and you can add annotation to a public domain work and then claim a copyright in the annotation part. But it's the law. If it's the law, then there's a strong policy argument that it can't be copyrighted. You know, incentives be damned, creativity be damned. And so so that's the problem that Georgia is running into here. They would like to monetize and monetize the creative activity of the state lawyers who are writing these annotations. But if they want it to be the law, they can't do it.
Well, but think about this, Brandon. The reason why, fundamentally, in my view, that the laws themselves are not copyrightable is that people out in public are held to have notice of those laws. And if they violate those laws, whether they were actually aware of them or not, they can be liable for that violation. So it would be horribly unfair to create some form of private ownership interest in a body of words or data that you're held legally to be aware of, and also make you pay for that awareness. Whereas annotations are different. They are not a form of law. There is no actual force of law behind the annotations. It's merely a collection of various courts that have ruled in connection with a particular provision of law that make those decisions relevant to someone who's looking into it, like a researcher. So in my view, there's a very big difference between the annotations themselves and the law itself. So yeah, I guess we could just disagree on that point.
All yeah, right. I think that's right. That's the merits. And yeah, we just disagree. You know, I think, but Carl would absolutely agree with your earlier statements about, you know, people are held to have notice. And it's, you know, and that's why in other activities he's going after the various codes and standards that are referred to in the law. So that basically anything that you need to know in order to follow the law, Carl says, should be in the public domain. So he's on a pretty
and I would agree. Yeah, we would agree on that.
Cool.
Let's make the price of law our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. MCLE stands for Mandatory Continuing Legal Education. So if you're a lawyer and you listen to this show and in your jurisdiction you need to log hours demonstrating that you are keeping yourself up to speed on cutting edge legal issues such as what we are discussing right here and now, we put these phrases in the show so you can demonstrate to whoever may be curious that you actually watched or listened and didn't just write it down on a list somewhere. So if you need more information about that, you can go to wiki.twit.tv, find our show page there, and we have a nice spreadsheet of the requirements for submitting, asking for credit in the various jurisdictions of the United States. And as I understand it, various other professions require you to stay up to speed on these sorts of issues too. So if you're a non-lawyer and you need to demonstrate that you watched or listened, feel free. Let's move on to some entertainment-related topics. All kinds of good stuff here. Brandon, you let us know right before the show about an important case involving Film on X, which was the Aereo competitor making similar arguments to Aereo in courts, I think not just in California, but perhaps elsewhere. Correct me if I'm wrong. And they have just gotten a district court decision that was quite a surprise, that given that the Supreme Court smashed Aereo and decided it walks like a cable company, quacks like a cable company, and must be a cable company. Apparently, Film On, at least initially in its first definitive decision from a trial court, and of course this will be reviewed on appeal, has gotten different treatment and may well be able to continue operating and allowing its customers to receive broadcast television without paying cable fees. First off, Brandon, can you describe, is Philmont's technology exactly like Aereo's or somewhat different?
You know, for all intents and purposes, it's the same. In the opinion that we're going to be talking about, the court describes the technology in some detail. And the one thing that's different is that Philmont has two versions of its antenna systems. One of them is exactly like Aereo's. That is, you know, it's thousands of dime-sized antennas, and every user gets his or her own antenna whenever they log in. But the second system has one really big antenna that is then channeled through thousands of slightly smaller antennas or something, which was meant to do the same kind of, you know, hocus-pocus that Aereo did. And, you know, diligent listeners will know that all of this was meant to get these systems under the heading of a private performance under the Second Circuit's Cablevision decision, which that was the big opinion from the Supreme Court that said, no, we're not gonna let you multiply antennas and pretend you're not a cable system. If you feel and look like a cable system to your user, then you are, you know, subject to the same requirement to buy a license that cable systems are subject to. That's what brings us to where we are today, because the obvious rejoinder then was, well, then we should get all of the rights that cable systems have, and one of those rights is a compulsory license under the law. You know, if you're a cable system, then you can pay a set fee and have and be entitled to local broadcasts. You know, the broadcasters can't withhold their consent. So that's what we just, that's what Philmont just won. That's what we see happening in this decision out of the California court. Philmont was found to be a cable system under the law. The court said, look, the Supreme Court says you're basically a cable system, so you get basically the same rights as a cable system. And this is a blockbuster thing because it means Philmont is still alive. Aereo is in the dustbin of history now. They've been bankrupt and sold off. And, you know, TiVo bought their trademarks and there's really nothing left of them. But Philmont's soldiering on, and they may well win the day.
They may indeed. And as I said, the Ninth Circuit will be the next place where this case is considered. And what do you think will happen, Brandon? Well, do you think, did the trial court say anything about what Philmont should be paying to retransmit, or did they leave that question for another day?
They left that question for another day. So we don't know the details of, you know, how it might shake out. If they were decided, you know, if it was decided that they're entitled to the license, then they would have to go and seek the license. And I'm not sure the exact workings of how that goes, but just being entitled is huge, and it could happen in the Ninth Circuit. I mean, the judge's opinion here is really quite compelling. I recommend it to readers who are lawyers or listeners who are lawyers and enjoy reading a good opinion. I think this is a good opinion. You know, basically the court says, look, the Copyright Office has always hated compulsory licenses, and so they didn't want them to expand, but the Copyright Office has never given a good reason why an internet-based retransmission service isn't a cable system for purposes of Section 111. They've never given a good explanation of that. And so other courts have deferred to the Copyright Office. That's the real source of how past internet companies have not been able to win this argument, because the Second Circuit deferred in the IVI case to the Copyright Office. But this court says, you know what? The Copyright Office doesn't get our deference this time. There's no ambiguity in the statute. They aren't particularly empowered to interpret this statute or fill gaps in the statute. And so we can read a statute just as well as they can, and the plain text of the statute seems to apply just fine. I'm convinced. I mean, I think it's actually a quite good opinion, and I'm curious to see whether we see a circuit split between the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit on this issue, because then, you know, we might see a Supreme Court decision.
Right. And then they'd get to grapple with these issues all over again. Now is when I get to tell my related but unrelated anecdote that happened a couple of months ago, and it was International Donut, not International, National Go Have a Donut Day here in the United States. And we were going to have a donut. And we were parked in front of a huge line out the donut shop's door. And parked in front of the donut shop, taking advantage of the fact that there was a crowd there, was a car with its hatchback open and a bunch of signage and equipment in the back. And my son and his buddy were intrigued, to say the least, because they were showing, you know, some sort of shiny tech object, and they had to go find out what it was. What I finally determined it was a torrent box, a all-in-a-box, no-hassle, we-are-your-BitTorrent solution that you hook up to your TV, and they had some menu system and you know, could find you any movie or TV show that you wanted. And the hysterical tie-in with Filmon and Aereo here is they had blown up a big copy of a newspaper article on the Aereo decision claiming that the Supreme Court said their product was legal.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. I sat there with my jaw on the ground and tried to engage the guys in conversation, but they were determined that the Aereo decision made their torrent box legal. And as I tried to explain the various ways in which that wasn't the case, they very rapidly closed their hatchback and drove off. Aereo crops up in interesting ways. David, any thoughts on this before we move on?
No, I concur with Brandon. Sounds like it was a really well thought out decision. And it's nice to see some courts looking into the details and applying the law and not just relying on the government office.
All right. And Sarah, any care to guess what's going to happen next with this?
Ooh, I won't do the fortune telling thing, but I guess I'm just curious. I didn't read the opinion yet. I want to, though, especially after Brandon's recommendation. But I don't fully understand what the argument is that it's not a cable system, or where, I guess, where the definition is. I was just trying to quickly look at the U.S. code, and I don't see a definition of cable system. But Brandon, do you know from the opinion, did he address like what the argument is that it wouldn't be falling under the statute?
That's one of the reasons that this opinion is so strong, and why I'm sort of optimistic, is that it does address that very directly. You know, cable system is defined as a facility that is located within a state that, via means of a communications system, makes broadcast content available, you know, transmitted to users, right? And so in the past, I think the Copyright Office and then willing deferential courts have said that that an internet rebroadcaster isn't a facility because the internet isn't a facility, and that that they're not located in a state for reasons that I actually never could define. It's just silly. It's very bad reasoning, and I have to say, they're pretty hard on the Copyright Office. The court has a whole section where he basically says, look, the Copyright Office doesn't like compulsory licenses and it doesn't like Section 111. And I think the Copyright Office is trying to contain Section 111 because it doesn't like it. And, you know, but Congress clearly liked it because it passed it, right? And so the court says, look, if the Copyright Office thinks that 111 is bad, and so expanding 111 would be very bad, but Congress thought 111 was good, then perhaps expanding 111 would be very good. As I said, it's a really fun read. And again, the arguments against these things being cable systems come out looking pretty flimsy. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting.
All right. I want to talk about Apple Music here in a moment, and I really want to talk a lot about drones in a longer moment. But before we get to that, I think it would be a really good time, if you've been sitting down like we all are, to stand up and have a good stretch and think about whether you should be sitting down all the time when you're working. Did you know that the average office worker spends 5 hours and 41 minutes sitting at their desk each day? And we all know that being sedentary isn't good for you. According to research conducted by the Mayo Clinic, it's putting you at a much greater risk for the whole for a whole range of health problems and shortening your lifespan. You've probably heard about the benefits of a standing desk. And that's why I want to tell you about Varidesk. Varidesk offers a variety of height-adjustable desks that let you easily switch between sitting and standing. And unlike other options, you don't have to get rid of your existing desk. Yay! Varidesk converts your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk with no assembly, installation, or boss approval required. It comes fully assembled. You just pull it out of the box, put it on your desk, and place your monitors and gear on it. Then you're ready to work in no time. When you want to stand, simply raise the Varidesk by using the convenient handles on either side. The spring-loaded boost mechanism makes raising your monitors and keyboards effortless. Varidesk is adjustable with 11 different height settings. And because Varidesk sits on top of your existing workspace, it's more affordable and easier to set up than other standing desks. Prices start as low as $275 plus shipping. Lifehacker included Varidesk in their 5 Best Standing Desks guide, and it also has been featured on Product Hunt and Gear Patrol. We've got a Varidesk Pro Plus 36 in the brick house at Twit, and now everybody wants one. And I wish I had had one just this last week when I was traveling. You guys probably noticed if you watched the last couple of shows, I wasn't in my home office. We did some really fun family travel where we all converged in Utah. And my father and stepmom drove out there. So long drive from California to Utah. And he had actually gotten a terrible muscle spasm in his back and had a bunch of work that he needed to do in Utah. And the way he got it done and dealt, you know, with his long drive back problem was to perch his laptop on our fireplace mantle and type up there. So this is definitely a better kind of solution. I wish that Varidesk had been around for us then. And it's a great thing to have around for your day-to-day work life as well as emergency family dilemmas. So visit Varidesk.com to learn more about Varidesk and check out their wide range of height adjustable desks for your desk or cubicle. And when you purchase a Varidesk, be sure to tell them that you heard about it here at the Twit Network on This Week in Law. That's Varidesk, V-A-R-I-Desk.com, Varidesk. And we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Law. All right, Apple Music. Folks have had various issues with it as far as some coming out of the gate, growing pains. I personally haven't experienced any of those. I've really actually been enjoying the service quite a bit. But Brandon, you linked to something that I thought was quite interesting, pointing up the difference between iTunes Match and the iCloud Music Library. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, so I'm an iTunes Match user, and I have a rather like absurd library of MP3s. And so I've not gotten into Apple Music yet, even though it really looks delicious, because there's been all of these technical issues with folks who, you know, what iTunes Match would do, what it does, is it will scan all of the MP3s and music files in your iTunes library and match them and then make them available to any device that you sign into, any Apple device that you sign into via the cloud. So I can buy a new record from any service. I use eMusic and Amazon a lot, drag it into my iTunes account, and then open up my iPhone a few minutes later, and there it'll be, and I can download it to my iPhone, and it'll be DRM-free, or I can go to my office and my computer in my office and download it there DRM-free, you know, because I own it. I bought it, I own it, and Apple is just helping me move it around. It's almost like a Dropbox just for music, and that's great. And then along comes iCloud Apple Music, and what Apple Music does is it has this thing called iCloud Music Library. And it does something similar. It says, okay, here's all the stuff that you own, and so we'll let you listen to that as part of the Apple Music experience on all of your devices. But when you go to download it on another device, you know, it is encumbered with DRM. You can't keep it, right? And so if you cancel your Apple Music subscription, that copy will disappear. So if I buy something on Amazon at home, drag it into my iTunes library, what Apple Music will do is scan it, and then when I'm back in my office, it'll let me listen to it in my office and even download it for offline listening. But when I cancel my subscription, all those copies that it makes other than the ones I initially bought from Amazon are going to disappear. They've got DRM on them and they'll go away. And you know, initially people were really upset because Apple Music couldn't tell the difference between iTunes Match users who are paying an extra $30 a year and non-Match users. And they were putting DRM on everybody's stuff. And there was a real, you know, consternation that, you know, I'm paying for this service and now what I'm getting is this crummy DRM version. But I think they've cleared that up. And so now what happens is unless you pay for Match, they'll only give you the things that you've paid for elsewhere within the Apple Music interface under a DRM, you know, situation. So again, it'll disappear when you stop paying. All of this just kind of points out the confusion about buying versus subscribing and how hard it is to thread that needle. You know, Apple is trying to say you can sign up for Apple Music, you can be a subscriber, but you can also still be an owner, and we'll mix all that stuff together and you can make playlists that have both our music and your music and it'll all work. And, you know, like with any, you know, version 1.0 product, it didn't all work, at least at first. And I think that's got people gun shy. You know, I'm pretty gun shy about it now.
Yeah, it certainly would have been nice if Apple Music had come out with a very simple explainer that ran down, you know, for existing iTunes Match customers, there wasn't any kind of notice given whatsoever or explanation as to how iCloud Music was going to differ from Match. There certainly wasn't any sort of opportunity to cancel your iTunes Match account if you decided, oh, well, iCloud Music does everything I need it to do and I don't care so much about the DRM. You know, they're not asking people to stop paying that $30 a year. So, yes, it would have been nice if they'd thought through all this stuff before coming out with Apple Music. But I guess hindsight is 20/20. Sarah, what do you think?
I haven't tried it. I probably won't. I think I've talked before about how I'm just a Spotify free user and I don't really have my own music and I'm okay with that, but I'm not much of a music person. It seems like from reading these articles, a lot of them are unintentional technical issues that they'll probably work out. Although I think Brandon's onto something too with this whole dichotomy between owning and selling and how to mix those, I think does just raise a lot of complexities and also surprises people a lot. But yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. But I haven't had any personal experience with it.
Right. David, do you have any thoughts on the subscribe versus own dichotomy, DRM, or anything else related to Apple Music?
I do. Actually, one time I represented a group of clients that created a music subscription service. They sold it for a few million dollars. One of those people is now at the upper levels of Apple and is instrumental in Beats, the Beats One radio network, which I happen to love. I think Beats is a great idea. I do not support, however, Apple Music, and here's the reason why. First, I don't believe that Apple does anything unintentionally. It's just not in their corporate culture. Two, I've been using these Apple devices and computers for about 22, 23 years, and I'm a devoted Apple computer fan, but I don't trust Apple Inc. I just don't trust them. And I think that it's borne out, my distrust of them is borne out by them forcing the U2 album onto people without their permission. It's just a complete overreach. And I think that them making some confusion between the iTunes Match and the Apple Music DRMs and having, you know, that one article about someone's music being deleted off of their computer or accounts so that they were no longer able to access it is just another symptom of a bigger problem that I believe Apple has unfortunately become a totalitarian company and they're looking for complete control over their interface with you as a customer and over the data that you share with them that they share back with you. So I, for one, would never sign up to a service that would interfere with files that I perhaps, you know, collected over the years, maybe even transferred from old audio tapes, believe it or not, or vinyl records, and digitized them and had them as part of a collection. I too have an absurd music collection from the standpoint of what some people might think. I really like my old music. I'm just an old timer that way. So yeah, I like some of what they're doing when it comes to the streaming radio. I do not like what they're doing when it comes to music files and who owns them and how they're accessed and monetized. And frankly, I don't think they can be trusted.
Well, I think Spotify and others are with you on that. And the FTC is actually investigating how Apple's 30% fee that it charges to subscription services who sign up new users through the App Store, whether that might be an anti-competitive practice. I remember seeing a few weeks ago that Spotify had a pretty funny ad campaign going where it was educating people about the fact that you did not need to get your Spotify through the App Store and that you could go elsewhere and the fee, you know, I don't think it's the users who are hit with the fee. It's Spotify who, but of course it passes the cost through. But it was an interesting marketing campaign that actually was going after Apple for that very point. Brandon, do you think now that Apple has its own music service that this becomes a problem?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And, you know, Apple, I'm with David insofar as I am a longtime Apple fanboy. You know, I'm doing this on a MacBook Air. I'm surrounded by, you know, I've got an iMac to my left and an iPad in my bag and an iPhone in my pocket. So, you know, they've got me. They've absolutely got me. I am theirs, you know, to own and control. But I don't want them to have my music in that way. And that sort of freaks me out. And it's clear they are ruthless business people. They just absolutely will chase every dollar. You know, those biographies of Steve Jobs, the Walter Isaacson biography was so interesting because he's this, you know, smelly, non-showering, flower-sniffing, hardcore capitalist, right? And so, you know, this 30% thing is not an accident. I'm sure that it is an anti-competitive move. And so, you know, they deserve it. They deserve to get beat up over it. It's not good for the users. You know, if you're a Kindle user, to have to go to the website and buy a book and then go to the Kindle app to read it, it's just obnoxious. But Apple wants you to use iBooks instead. And so they make it hard. And so Apple should take some heat for this. The other thing that's interesting, I saw a lot of people in the IRC talking about whether you own a file, you know, and some folks are saying, look, if you don't have a disc, then you don't really own anything. I'm really sympathetic to that. I don't think it's literally true. I think I own the file that's on my hard drive. And really what I do is I own my hard drive. And then what iTunes Match does is it gives me a kind of license that Apple negotiated with the labels that lets me make copies of that file from the hard drive. But so far it looks like, you know, even to transfer my files to a new hard drive is sort of a gray area where I would say maybe it's a fair use, hopefully. And all of that pushes me to think, you know, that owning files and trying to treat files like a real collection was probably a big mistake for me. And I've been going increasingly back to vinyl for things that I want to really own. And then maybe Apple Music for things that I kind of like but don't really care about. And the files are sort of a worst of both worlds compromise.
Yeah, you mentioned the deal that Apple had to strike to make iTunes Match work. And I think people forget the significance of that, how that was such a huge shift for the record labels to enable people to basically locker their music and move it around and store it wherever they wanted to. So many lawsuits. And in fact, for a long time, the MP3.com lawsuit was the biggest copyright damages award ever handed down by a jury in a court, all over the ability to use music that you had purchased. The mp3.com one was about CDs and demonstrating that you owned the CD and therefore you could have a cloud copy of it. That was just not permitted. And so for Apple to be able to negotiate that was quite a big deal. And I think it's something, you know, that maybe is starting, as you say, to become obsolete for people who just listen to music casually, but for people who really care about not, you know, having an enduring library that cannot be pulled out from under them based on EULA terms. This is a very big deal. Oh, and for, you know, we've been talking about everybody being Apple fanboys. I found this cleaning my office lately. The original very slick pamphlet that was done for the, you know, lamp-looking iMac. Very fun little piece of Apple history to stumble across in all my files. I think that we're just about ready to talk about drones. So let's do that. Too bad our robots aren't flying for you, David, but let's talk about those that do fly. Of course, the story that's been much on people's minds over the last week or so is this teen in Connecticut who armed up a drone and took some video of it. And now the FAA and others are wringing their hands going, well, gee, what are we going to do about this? It doesn't technically seem to have been illegal, but it probably should be. Can you give us your take?
Sure. First, I love this story. It involves my two favorite things, drones and handguns. And so I was really happy to see this. I can't believe that the law enforcement in Connecticut are unable to put together a criminal case on this guy. It's clear to me that this is criminal reckless endangerment. Anybody mm-hmm. who's ever shot a handgun knows that if it's tilted upward, like the artillery, if it's tilted, it can go for a mile. And that projectile can land on somebody, it can kill them. So what we're saying is just because they were on a small piece of private property that they luckily did not harm somebody, that itself was not a crime, that should not be. It should be illegal under existing laws. It's not legal for somebody to wantonly and recklessly point their handgun or any other firearm into the air and shoot it not knowing where the projectile is going to land. This is absurd. So that's number one. They should charge the father and the son with criminal conspiracy and reckless endangerment and bring them through the criminal court system. Number two, I can't believe the FAA, after sending all those $10,000 cease and desist letters to photographers, that they can't find a way to define this as a hazardous and wrongful activity. That's ridiculous. Number three, I have deep, deep qualms. As much as I love drones, robots, all the technology that's associated with that, the fact is that when you are handling a handgun, you need to be aware of the main safety rules, which is you don't put your finger on the trigger until you're ready to shoot. You don't shoot anything you don't want to destroy, and you don't shoot unless the background is clear. You need to know what's behind where you're shooting. How can somebody possibly do that handling the fine controls of a drone? I just don't understand it. So I'm against what has happened. I think it was a great video, great news, really exciting to talk about. I think that it's a crime and it should be prosecuted, and the full force of the criminal justice system, so to speak, should be brought down on this father and son. It's just completely unacceptable.
All right. Well, that's a very definite point of view. And I think I'm with you. I'm actually really surprised that they haven't found a way to take action about this and make an example, right? Because if one person does it, that sort of opens the floodgates to all drone and handgun owning enthusiasts who want to see how the two can get along together. Brandon, I'm curious from your perspective as a law professor, whether this scenario reminds you at all of the cases that we all studied in torts in law school that involved the spring-loaded trap gun garage door protection mechanisms. If for those of you who didn't have to labor through these in law school, there were folks out there who decided that they were going to automate their security system, their home security system, in sort of a Rube Goldberg way. And instead of calling the police or setting off an alarm when a door opened in an unauthorized or unexpected way, a gun was trained at the door and set to go off. Those were found to be illegal. Mm. Are we in the same kind of territory here?
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. I mean, with all of these sort of, you know, robot murder drone, dangerous drone type cases, you know, that gets back to good old, you know, torts and causality, right? Is who's the proximate cause of the harm? You know, can we, you know, people keep saying, well, can a robot commit murder? Or, you know, no, but a person can use a robot to commit murder, and that shouldn't be so mind blowing, right? And so the fact that, you know, this kid is firing a gun, using a remote control, you know, and using a drone doesn't make it legal. I love David's approach to this. You know, too often I think there's a sense that when something is done with technology, it's new. I mean, right? We have this problem in patents, right? Like, you know, well, if I until Alice v. CLS Bank, anyway, we had this idea that, you know, if I do something with a computer, suddenly I've innovated. And similarly here, you know, carrying a gun around willy-nilly is a problem, and doing it with a drone is also a problem. So I think that's a very important, very big picture principle to keep in mind, that technology doesn't actually scramble the fundamental principles of basic legal obligations like the duty of care.
Absolutely. Sarah, anything you want to add?
No, I mean, David summed it up really well. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Okay, we've got more drone-y stuff we can talk about. It seems like my desire to have tacos and pizzas delivered by drone is coming closer to reality. The first FAA approved delivery was medicinal in purpose and did not involve feeding somebody's late night munchy cravings, but it is a step in that direction, and it did not involve Amazon. Can you tell us about that, David?
Yeah, I think this was just a terrific development. I was really pleased to see that, contrary to your pizza wishes, that this was used in a way that helps people in a remote area access medical supplies. This has immediate applications for disaster relief, which is a big need all throughout the United States and throughout the world. I was just delighted. I was also happy that they took the time to get the FAA permit. It looks like more and more companies are finding that that's not a horribly difficult obstacle for these kinds of projects. What can I say? It was really excellent video to watch, and the context was perfect as far as I'm concerned.
All right. What do you think, Brandon? Obviously, as delivery drones are starting to get licenses and approval from the FAA, that raises a number of what we were just talking about, common sense safety issues that don't change just because we're using drones. How do you think the FAA and the state governments are going to deal with that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I'm not very good at predicting that kind of stuff, especially. So the FAA and state law are a little bit beyond my ken, but I will say that, you know, I think this is such a clever way to, you know, break the seal on this question of whether drone delivery could be a good thing, dropping medicine on people who need it, right? Genius.
<These guys. laughs> Let's hope they didn't drop it too hard.
Yeah, right. Get them down pretty low before you drop it on them, or, you know, drop it with some Advil also attached in case you hit them. Right. But yeah, I think that's pretty, it's a public relations coup. Good for them.
Yep. Sarah, what do you think?
I don't know much about it. I mean, I am curious, is Amazon about to start doing this? Or there was a lot of talk about Amazon, or, you know, surprised that Amazon wasn't the first. And it sounded like from the article that they now have their license to, but I might have read that wrong. I don't know if David knows what the status is there.
Right. They certainly came out gung-ho, what was it, more than a year ago now, with their video, et cetera. Do you know what their status is?
Well, I believe, and I haven't seen their paperwork or their licenses, but my understanding is that they initially went ahead without a license or a proper license. They got some flack for that. They retreated a little bit, hired the proper lawyers, got the right paperwork in, and then got their license, but then their technology had become somewhat obsolete. They needed to update their technology, and they found a way to get them to meet in an opportune place, and that's where they're at right now. So it looks to me like this is the kind of company that will have a good chance for raising financing, selling products, entering into joint ventures, and the like. I would keep an eye on this company.
All right. You know, we have a story here we can tie into the story we started out the show with, the Ashley Madison hack. There we had someone who didn't approve of Ashley Madison and hacked their website, released data. Here we had someone who didn't approve or just wanted to be juvenile about a big billboard bearing the image of Kendall Jenner. And what they did was hack a drone to go vandalize said billboard. David, can you tell us more about this?
Now, I'm sorry, but my reading of it was that we have a tagger graphic artist that used a drone to deface a billboard, not that the drone was hacked. Am I incorrect on that? Because I believe that that was the case, that this is a painting drone invented by a tagger, and he made the ultimate tag. Is that not the case?
The story that I saw, and let's see if we can find some more coverage on it, said it was a hacked drone. So
That might have been misreporting. I watched the video, and it seemed to me that this is part of a progression that this tagger uses. This is a person who believes that he or she has a right to deface public property in the name of art. I realize there are many people who share that view, and this is using a new technology to accomplish that same spray painting goal, but just at a much higher high-tech level.
Got it. Okay, so let's leave the hacking out of this story for purposes of the story, but talk about it hypothetically. Do you think that we saw the story also this week about the folks who got together and showed how the Jeep could be hacked as it was driving down the road? What do you think are the dangers of interfering with drones are going to start populating the skies?
Well, interfering with drones, interfering with devices, interfering with vehicles. I mean, the fact that they were able to shut off the brake system on that Jeep, it's why I sold my Jeep with its four onboard computers, and I drive a 1965 Dodge truck that has no computers. I don't believe that private companies are able to keep up with the anti-hacker technology. We've also had a case in the past, I think, 6 to 9 months where an industrial facility's computer systems were hacked, and the facility was meant to overheat to the point of nearly exploding. And we have now, I mean, that is basically the beginning of a terrorist act through the simple hacking of an industrial facility. And in every country, there are thousands and thousands of factories of various kinds that are not even considered security-related factories, but are capable of being blown up remotely by telling the computer to turn off the cooling system or overload this circuit or that circuit. You know, when you combine this with an understanding of the White House Office of Personnel Management hack, probably one of the all-time most successful hacks in the history of the world to date, you have people probably buying and selling personal confidential information of high-placed government employees. And what stops them from hacking those people's cars or someone who wants to affect a person to veto a certain measure, give a certain permit? Oh, we just took control of your family's minivan and nearly drove them off the road. We really want this permit to be approved. Is it going to get approved? Yes. So, you know, I think we're in a whole new world here of extortion, blackmail of government officials, as if it wasn't bad enough already when it just involved suitcases full of money. Now we have the potential for serious underground threatening and coercion of public officials. What can be done about it? I don't know. There needs to be obviously a lot of funding and engineering and people working on anti-hacking security techniques, not just the handful of people devoted to it right now. I would like to see universities. I would like to see the government funding of anti-hacking technologies, security systems, and the like to prevent these kinds of things. And the more startup a company is, or the tighter budget a company is on for developing a particular product, the less opportunity there will be to implement those sort of security devices. So the same technology that allowed someone to get on a plane, I believe it was in Boston or something like that, and use the headphone jack of a commercial airliner to access that airliner's computer systems, is the same thing that allows these hackers into the Jeeps to get into the computers of the car. And if you've ever had a computer fail while you're driving, like I have, and the car just stops running and you can't figure out why, and it turns out it was a bad computer chip or a bad computer module, then you'll have firsthand experience of what it can be like. So I would be very concerned if I were out there, and my family does have a late model minivan, I would be very concerned if somebody were to come and try to hack it for the purpose of influencing me in something. Thank goodness I don't do anything that is government related. I don't make any decisions like that affect other people's lives or their livelihoods. And so I wouldn't be at risk for that. But there are a lot of people who are making those decisions and who are at risk of that.
Well, you've just pointed out quite eloquently, and you wouldn't necessarily think there is a copyright law tie in here, but there is, why the DMCA should be amended or otherwise addressed to allow the kind of research that you're talking about, David. Brandon, I saw the Rebecca Tushnet post you just stuck in our rundown with the awesome headline, Washington Post explains how the DMCA will kill your family. Do you want to elaborate on what she means?
I would love to. Yeah, there is a DMCA angle on this issue. The DMCA, and in fact, this is happening right now. The Copyright Office is in the final throes, Lord willing, of the rulemaking where they decide, you know, what kinds of things can be, what kinds of anti-circumvention measures that protect copyrighted works can be circumvented by the public without asking permission from the rights holder. And of course, all of the software on these cars is protected by anti-circumvention measures. It's encrypted and so on and so forth. And the car makers have said, you know, look, if you allow people to circumvent software on our cars, you know, you're basically allowing hacking. But the very good point that Rebecca makes, and she points to the Post and a big article about hacking cars that the Washington Post did, is look, people can hack cars, right? Hackers can hack cars. There's just no doubt about it. But, you know, when you outlaw researching security flaws, then only outlaws will know what security flaws there are, right? And so for the utopia, or not utopia, but at least the very good situation that David described, where universities and all kinds of people are digging into software vulnerabilities and figuring out how to make cars more secure, that cannot happen unless there's an exception for security research that permits people to mess around with this software and discover how it works. So for now, we're relying on the Copyright Office to give us that power to make our cars more safe, which sounds insane, right? Why is the Copyright Office empowered with protecting our cars? And it's, again, because of that weird, you know, DMCA, like a sort of weird Swiss Army knife that sort of all kinds of people like to use to keep you from getting your hands on their stuff.
In the current rulemaking that you mentioned, Brandon, are we in another 3-year period where it will be revisited, or is there any consideration going on of extending that and making some exemptions permanent?
There are, you know, within the legislature, there are considerations along those lines. You know, it's something that several people have raised as, you know, if we're going to do copyright reform, then that should be in the mix. But for now, we're just at the mercy of every 3 years the Copyright Office decides. And so if the Copyright Office decided this time, you know, look, it was a bunch of students in law clinics, like my students. We were the only ones standing up for this kind of stuff, representing hackers and security researchers. And if we weren't able to satisfy the Copyright Office that this is important, it'll be 3 years before we get another chance. You know, and who knows what can happen in the meantime. And we know from the Film on X case how the Copyright Office feels about messing around with people's copyright prerogatives, right? So they're a little bit disinclined to listen to us. So, but hopefully we've overcome that this cycle, but we won't know until the rules come out probably later this year.
All right, we have one final drone story to get to. David, the firefighters in Northern California don't want drones getting in their way. That's one way that as commercial drones start to get more and more prevalent, the firefighters, and I'm sure various other public safety personnel are concerned about being able to do their jobs. Now, could you elaborate, too, on whether there's any consideration of how drone technologies might be integrated by the firefighters? Presumably, they're not against that kind of drone use. They just don't want to have their activities interfered with. Am I getting close to the mark there?
Definitely, Denise. I mean, I know of at least one firefighter department that has put drones into place. They're using drones actively in South Dakota for spotting fires or helping personnel understand if there are people at risk or animals at risk. And so I think that there's an eagerness to incorporate this technology into actual firefighting. And at the same time, I think we need to respect firefighters. It's a very difficult job, especially people in California, but elsewhere in South Dakota, all through the West. Fires are happening. As some places dry out, there's more risk of fire. And fire is a terrifying thing. It can wipe out a home, household, and all a person's memories in just a matter of minutes. And we want people who are firefighters, which is also a very brave, uncompensated or lowly compensated activity, to be able to do their jobs when there are fires. We're talking about very difficult work, very often underappreciated work, and work against nature itself, fire being one of the age-old elements. Whenever we interfere with firefighting, we're putting lives at risk, we're putting people's property at risk, and to do that for amusement or to do that so people can post YouTube videos, I think is unconscionable. I was glad to see in one of the articles you posted there was some remorse on behalf of or by somebody who had done that. And yet at the same time, the remedies that are being proposed at state levels, for example, in California with some proposed legislation, are completely inadequate. There's nothing that California can do, for example, that would contradict or contravene FAA rules having to do with destroying or spiffing or taking over or deactivating drones. California cannot authorize it. The FAA could authorize it. So I think California is barking up the wrong tree, so to speak. What they should be doing is working with other states that are concerned about this issue to get the FAA to provide the proper authorization, if such a thing can be done, to destroy a drone that's interfering with firefighting or rescue activities. Clearly, a state could pass a law that authorizes law enforcement to take possession, seize the controller, have the drone cease activity, arrest the person operating the drone for interfering with rescue operations or firefighting operations. When you read that the firefighters had to call off rescue helicopters or planes dropping retardant for a 15-minute period and allow the fires to continue without any firefighting at all for 15 minutes, knowing that people's lives are in the way. I mean, to me, that's just a horrible, horrible result. And I think a lot of this has to go to the element of responsible droning, which is a phrase I coined last year to try to encourage people to think about using the technology responsibly. I think remote control aircraft operators have for decades operated very responsibly. You never heard about remote control aircraft operators getting involved and messing with rescue or firefighter operations. And I think the reason why is that those are typically groups that associate together. They typically have an association rule set. They typically follow safety protocols. And so it probably never occurred to most of those hobbyists to go ahead and do something like this. Now, where there's an attraction to post things on YouTube and gather likes and possibly even monetize those YouTube likes, we have a strong economic and narcissistic incentive to do reckless things. I sort of harken back to my earlier discussion about the handgun armed drone. This is another example of someone just acting recklessly because they could. And just because you can doesn't mean that it's responsible, lawful, or should be. So, we're still in a gray area here. And if California does pass its law, I still wouldn't think that any firefighters are authorized to try to shoot drones out of the air, for example. They wouldn't be qualified to do that. And so they'll probably just keep calling off their rescue efforts and putting the blame on whoever the individual drone operator is until there is some satisfaction at the federal level.
Maybe they need one of those devices that people use to walk into bars and change the channel of the TV or turn off all the TVs where you could interfere with the drone and just drop it.
Well, that would be great, except what if it drops on a bunch of people? And and you have a 5-pound drone that falls on someone. We saw last year in New York that someone got themselves killed when their drone was operating directly overhead. It ran out of battery. It hit them on the head. Some people call that karma. In any case, it didn't work out well.
Right. And it wasn't even carrying medicine, unfortunately. I lied. I said we were just going to do the firefighter drone story. But let's work in AeroSense to the new Sony business, because I think it relates to what we're talking about. Certainly there are going to be people who are out there using drones for all of the reasons you just discussed, David. But there are going to be businesses out there using drones as well, trying to make a buck. And here is Sony coming into the drone business with this AeroSense project, which sort of seems like its attempt to get into the Google Maps, Google Earth, Google Street View space without using cars with cameras on them and satellites. Instead, it's going to bring the aerial photography much closer to home and use drones in order to, here's quoting from the TechCrunch article, capture images and other data for business purposes using unmanned crafts. So you could definitely see one of these there are legal issues, of course, all around this. They're going to face the same kinds of legal issues and dilemmas that Google has over the years in trying to create a visual version of the world for people to refer to. You know, how is Sony going to deal with all of the data that it's gathering? Is it going to respond to people's requests to gray out faces? All the things that Google's had to deal with. And also, they could very well find themselves getting in the way of the kinds of rescue operations that you've been talking about, David.
Well, I'm all in favor of business uses of drones. The more, the better. I think it's an excellent way to actually get a lot of these issues resolved. In my experience, many more issues get resolved at the financier's table than get resolved in Congress or the courts. You have a company of entrepreneurs that want to do something, or a division of Sony that wants to do something. They need some money for that, or they need joint venture partners, or they need bank financing, or they need venture capital. And the venture capital folks, the financiers, will come up with a list of risk factors. And these risk factors will have to be resolved before the company will get its money. So a lot of those issues, I think, will get solved in the business environment. I think it's an excellent business model. I also saw something very similar to it with a water-based it was aquatic robot kind of drone that was put out as a big hurricane was hitting the Pacific, had a number of sensors on it and digital feeds, and the company that owned it was selling the feeds, the digital feeds data feeds to different people, researchers, companies that wanted that information real time. It's a great business model, how to acquire data more efficiently, and it's a real business disruptor. I think it will ultimately supplant a lot of what Google and Google Earth has done, and make room for entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial companies. So I'm all for it.
All right. We'll definitely have to keep an eye on Sony and AeroSense. We're going to put our second MCLE passphrase into the show, and it's going to be drone karma. And I think we should land our droney show here with our tip of the week and resource of the week. Our resource of the week is an awesome one. You definitely need to check this out from the folks at New Media Rights. I get all kinds of questions in my law practice of people wanting to know whether a particular video use that they have in mind is going to be a fair use. And that is often a very complicated question. And when you are going to need to make some judgment calls about the risks involved, and there's always a risk involved in trying to figure out whether something's fair use, then you do need to hire a lawyer and just get someone's best analysis and best guess. But if you just aren't in the position of being able to do that, and you understand that this is not a substitute for a lawyer, then I really encourage you to check out the Fair Use app from the folks at New Media Rights. It is very, very cool. It takes you through a fair use analysis. It's skewed toward filmmakers and video creators, and it helps you at least understand the issues involved and begin to get an idea whether you're starting to come down, and a court might come down on the side of your use being fair use or an infringement. So definitely file this away. Anyone who makes films or posts videos and uses other people's work or would like to from time to time. And then our tip of the week is, I have a pretty good guess that everyone who watches, listens to this show would like to be at least as smart as a 2L in law school on internet law issues. And Professor Eric Goldman has some help for you to make yourself that smart, or at least test whether you think you're that smart. Professor Goldman created some multiple choice review questions for the 2015 edition of the Internet Law Casebook that he uses to teach. And unfortunately, he has not posted the answers. So it might be a bit frustrating for you if you are at all confused. He says, I expect most of you will find these questions really easy, but if you spot any ambiguities in them, haha, of course you will. Please email him so that he can approve them for the next edition. And if you're just dying to know the answers, I'm betting that if you emailed him, he'd let you know too. So if you want to be smarter than a 2L or see whether you are, definitely check out Professor Goldman's sample questions. What do you think, Brandon? Are you going to run these by your students too?
Of course. Hey, I'm like any professor. I need all the free questions I can get my hands on. I'll take
Sure, absolutely. All right. Well, we are going to bring our drone in for a landing without clonking anyone on the head with its cargo or mechanics, hopefully. Thank you so much, David Frankel, for joining us again. DroneLawyer.com and Drone_Lawyer on Twitter. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and you definitely are operating in one of the most interesting areas of the law right now, I believe. Please go check out DroneLawyer.com, and then you will find what's going on with David if you need further information from or about him. Brandon Butler, great to chat with you again.
Always a pleasure, Denise. Thanks for having me on.
You can find out more about Brandon at brandonbutler.info, and you can follow him on Twitter at @BC_Butler. How about with you? Anything going on at American University Washington College of Law that we should know about?
Just gearing up for next year. I'm going to teach the copyright class. So if anybody has any good hypos they want to throw at me, you can, at me on Twitter.
Lucky students who get to take your class. I'm jealous of them. Folks, you should definitely follow along with Sarah on Twitter. She's S. Hinch Pearson there. And definitely check out the Kickstarter campaign that Creative Commons is running right now. Pretty worthwhile stuff going on there. If you've joined us on Friday to watch the show live, that means you've joined us at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record the show each and every week. We love it if you can join us live, but don't worry if you can't. The whole entire archive of our shows is available at twit.tv/twill. So you can catch us there on demand whenever you'd like. There are all kinds of instructions there for the various ways and various devices that you can watch the show on. So take advantage of that and watch on your own time. I was cracking up that Sue, the writer who does join us live almost every week and jumps into IRC, had to jump out of IRC because she was listening while she was vacuuming. Actually, she's still in there, it looks like. But so, great way to pass the time, whatever you're doing, vacuuming, driving, droning, just be safe as you're listening to the show. And get in touch with us between the shows. You can email Sarah. She's sarahp@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus if you have a little bit more to say. But do let us know what's on your mind, what you think we should be talking about, further points that you want to add to the discussion that we had. Resources you think we should see, guests you think we should invite on. All those suggestions are so, so helpful to us in doing the show. So keep them coming. Also, if you're looking for our list of links, things that we've looked at in prepping the show, they are at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/312 for this week's episode. And if anyone has a good delicious alternative that you think is just as easy to use as delicious, but Delicious has morphed into something that has quite a bit of ads unless you pay to drop them out, which I'm not dying to do. So I don't know. I've been flirting with whether we switch over to Reddit to do our show prep. If you have another tool that you think I should check out, I'd love to hear about it on that front too. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Thanks so much for joining us.